Welcome, viewers and listeners, to CHP Talks. My guest this week is Mr. Colin Craig, and Colin is the president of SecondStreet.org. If you don't know what that is, you should visit their website, SecondStreet.org. And today we're going to be talking about a project that they're doing called Survivors of Socialism. But first, I want to give you a little introduction to Colin. Colin Craig has two decades of public policy experience. He's helped shape government decisions at the municipal, provincial, and federal level. In 2018, he was hired to be the president of SecondStreet.org, and he played an instrumental role in launching this organization. Colin oversees the organization's groundbreaking research and storytelling activities, and we're going to talk about some of those stories today. I first met Colin through his work with the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, which is a great organization. And Colin was involved, one of the things that he did in that organization, he led their efforts to convince the federal government under Stephen Harper to draft and pass the First Nations Financial Transparency Act legislation, which improved financial transparency in First Nations communities. He's been involved in other fights to expose corruption in both the city of Winnipeg and city of Calgary's golden retirement plans. He has a degree in economics from the University of Manitoba. He was awarded the Queen Elizabeth II's Platinum Jubilee Medal in 2022 by the Premier of Alberta. Colin is the author of a book called The Government Wears Prada, and he contributed several chapters to the ebook Life After COVID. Colin, welcome to CHP Talks, and thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rod.
This is an important, I just came across this the other day in the Canadian Taxpayers magazine about your project, Survivors of Socialism. Can you describe a little bit what that project is about?
Yeah, so you'll know this, Rod, I'm sure a lot of your viewers will as well, that it's not uncommon in Canada to see different elected officials, academics, sometimes teachers and others, activists, advocating for socialism and communism. And you'll see people wearing hammer and sickle t-shirts sometimes and these types of imagery, which sadly are connected to an ideology that has led to human suffering all over the planet. Right now, if you go on the United Nations website, they'll tell you that there's 6 or 7 million Venezuelans who have had to flee their country because fundamentally the system has collapsed. I mean, socialism has been an abject failure in Venezuela. It's well known the suffering that occurred in China when the country was more of a communist socialist type of regime rather than right now. It's more of a market-based economy and people are doing a lot better. We know what happened in the former Soviet Union. We know about Cuba and other nations. So it's been sadly a real disaster all over the planet where these ideologies have been tried. And so we thought, you know what, let's do a couple things. One is talk to Canadians who came from these countries and share their stories so that people here can understand what it's like living in these structures of governance. But second, also talk to Canadians from these countries and survey them and say, is there anything happening in Canada that maybe you're concerned about because it reminds you of the country that you fled? So that was an interesting research project. We didn't know what to expect when we started it, but it's been really interesting talking to people from who have come from these countries all over the world.
Yeah, when I was a kid, we were quite aware of, you know, the Berlin Wall and that, you know, I remember the event when that was put up and then when it came down again, which I think was a wonderful surprise to most of us that they actually, something that so formidable could actually come down in our lifetimes. But back then and even today, people aren't trying to break into communist countries. Generally, they're trying to get out. And there's reasons for that. And so these survivors of socialism that you've contacted and interviewed, they are people who escaped in one way or another or emigrated from these dictatorial communist regimes. And maybe before we go too much further, can you describe the difference between communism and socialism? I know they're related. We use the terms almost interchangeably, but there may be some fine distinctions that you could help us with.
Yeah, and it does get a bit murky, Rod, because one of the things I noticed while working on this project is that you would find countries that would define themselves as perhaps socialist, but yet the governing party would be communist. So then you start to kind of wonder, okay, well, what type of structure is this? Cuba is one example. I believe I'd have to double check, but I'm pretty sure in the constitution of Cuba, they describe themselves as a communist nation, a socialist nation that is under one party rule by the communists. So you see that type of thing happening. The terms do, I think they're not always used correctly. You know, the key differences that I picked up is that for starters, both of them take the means of production and they put them in the state's hands. So when you're building things in factories or you're running agricultural land or whatever, all that gets put in the state's hands. And then communism goes a bit further and basically eliminates private property. So your household would also belong to the state, and basically individuals own next to nothing. So that's sort of the distinction from 10,000 feet up. But both are very similar, I would say, in terms of what we've observed in these different nations. Similar in that there's human suffering inevitably follows. I mean, you do not do well when you put so much power in the state's hands to have the state controlling and planning the economy. I mean, it's just been a disaster everywhere that's been tried. So,
well even the Soviet Union, the USSR, Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So they claimed that name, and of course, looking back over the last century, I think nobody minces any words to say that that was and is a communist regime. And I've got to tell you what, my eyes were opened back in the 70s when some folks that we knew, an older couple of gentlemen, two brothers that we knew up here in the north of BC, who their families had escaped from, you know, communist Russia. And we have various friends. Some of them escaped and some didn't escape. We have friends who left behind, relatives who were deliberately starved to death. But the Gulag Archipelago, written by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, really opened my eyes. I was fairly oblivious at that time. In the 60s, 70s, I kind of thought that, you know, socialism sounded pretty good, sounded social, you know, and use that word like society and social, and sort of like the difference between humanism and humanitarianism. They use some of the same terminology, but they can lead to different results. So the suffering that this man, Solzhenitsyn, you know, highlights what he went through in the prison camps, and many others suffered and died in those prison camps. It really opened my eyes to the depth of human depravity, I guess, in those dictatorial regimes. And of course, the word socialist even was connected with Hitler's regime, the National Socialist. You know, people usually think, oh, Hitler's way over on the right. They call him on the right, which is not, you know, an inaccurate way of looking at it. And they think, well, socialism is on the left. But it was the National Socialist Party that was actually the Nazi Party. So,
yeah, there's a debate about him and how he governed and all that. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the party that he was running was the National Socialist Party. But, you know, one of the points I like that you made earlier was that so often when it comes to these types of regimes, people are trying to escape. No one's trying to get into these countries. I mean, we know what happened in the former Soviet Union.
Yeah.
People trying to escape. Germans risked their lives trying to get over the Berlin Wall, as there would be these turrets and barbed wire, and I believe they had some landmines and whatever, and people would get shot at as they're trying to escape Germany from the east side, which was the communist side, to the more capitalist Western side. I mean, Cuba is another great example. You constantly see stories of people getting onto these small boats and rafts, and they'd have way too many people, and they'd be trying to escape the country. People in Cuba have even climbed into the wheel wells of airplanes to try and escape. And you hear these stories of people climbing in. The airplane goes up, I don't know how many feet, tens of thousands of feet, where it gets incredibly cold. So sometimes they die because they get so cold, but other times when the airplane comes down and the landing gear drops and these people are falling out, like it's incredible. But time and time again, you see people escaping these nations, trying to get free, trying to go to countries that are have more of a market-based economy. And it boggles my mind how anyone would be advocating these types of governance.
So what do you think is, like you mentioned early in the discussion here, that university professors and some of the middle of the road or even further to the left publications and news organizations seem to be talking about socialism as if it's a good thing, and I know that and that's probably the, one of the reasons that you are doing the work you're doing to educate our population. But in even in the public high schools today, many young people are getting the idea that socialism is a desirable way of looking at things. What is the fatal attraction of socialism? What is drawing people to make these wrong conclusions about socialism?
Well, it's always presented with flowery language. It's the promise of everyone's equal, everyone's going to do well, we're all going to work together, sing kumbaya, and things are going to be great. I mean, that's how it's always presented to people, and think, oh, this sounds pretty good. We'll all be equal and we can all work together and whatever. But it ignores human nature on many levels. Inevitably, someone rises to the top in these regimes. Inevitably, those people that do rise to the top, they treat themselves better than the average person. I mean, you look at the former Soviet Union, across from the Kremlin, there was an entire building where people who were leading that country could go and get access to special goods from the West, which the common person couldn't get. People would get more allotments of food and so forth. So, human nature on the one hand, it's not an equal system in the end. Inevitably it fails because there just aren't the incentives. I mean, society is full of people that have different levels of work ethic and so forth. You need the incentives that the profit creates for people to innovate and work hard and do well. And you don't have that in a collective society. So there are, I think those are some of the problems at the root of why these structures don't work. I think one reason why it endures, and PragerU has a good video that looks at why these communism and socialism have such terrible track records, and yet these ideas endure. You don't have that same sort of glorification of authoritarian, more sort of right of center, like fascism and that. I mean, no one is out there really pushing fascism as an idea, because it's a bad system. But what PragerU says about communism and socialism, one of the reasons why they think that these ideas continue on is that they don't take responsibility for their failures. I mean, you look at the former Soviet Union and they don't really acknowledge that the system was a failure, that people were treated horrifically, and so forth. They haven't taken responsibility there. I mean, there's been other examples too where these things have occurred. You look at China with Mao Zedong, who oversaw millions of people starving and dying under his communist rule. Well, in China, they refer to Mao's 80-20 rule, and they try to say, well, he got 80% of things right, but 20% he got wrong. And if anything, it's more the opposite. I mean, it was just an absolute disaster under Mao, but they haven't taken responsibility for him. He's still, at least when I was there 15 years ago, he was still on most of the nation's currency and that. So, I think that's a reason why these ideas persist. But There's certainly a lot of room for, I think, groups like ours to be out there and trying to inform young Canadians in particular about history and how these regimes actually operate. And with our series, we talk to Canadians who have come from all over the world from these different systems so that young people can hear directly from people who lived under these systems.
Yeah, I listened to several of your interviews. I hope to get to the rest of them soon. But you have people from China, from Estonia, from Cuba, and many other places who have survived. And that's your title of your project, "Survivors of Socialism." But they were able to get to the West, and they were, in some cases, they're blown away when they saw the prosperity and the variety of opportunities, both for goods, services, and for work for themselves, employment, in the West, which they had no idea, because that's one of the things that communism has done fairly successfully, I guess, is that they have censored information. They have kept either through the airwaves, through radio, and through print publications, they have limited, information about the West. They have vilified the West, that it's terrible over here. And, it's when you think about that, and you think about the current government's efforts to censor information so that people can't make their own, educated decisions about all kinds of things, whether it's the economy or vaccines, or just a making a forming an opinion about socialism, or who to vote for. If the government controls all that information, they can certainly get people to do things that are not in their best interest.
Yeah, you certainly want to limit how much power the state has in, I would say almost all areas of life, right? You don't want the state having too much control when it comes to being able to censor content from the public. You don't want them having too much control in terms of the economy, the goods and services that are available, tax rates and so forth. I mean, you want, I think in an ideal world, you want the state to be fairly small. Focus on those services that it should and allow maximum freedom so that people can flourish. But you're right. I mean, in so many of these former communist and socialist, and even some of the current ones, those types of countries, they very much seek to control information. And a great anecdote that one of the people we spoke with who came from Latvia, I believe it was, he shared this story about how under the former Soviet Union, when they controlled Latvia, they would even destroy cookbooks. And I said, well, why on earth would the state destroy cookbooks? And he said, well, they didn't want people looking at these old cookbooks and starting to ask questions. Well, why is it that my relatives had access to all these different ingredients and we can't find them in the state store today? So and the government's, quote unquote, solution was to just destroy these old cookbooks and try to prevent people from thinking about recipes of the past and questioning why this, and I'll put it, say great in air quotes, great system of governance, no longer is able to provide all these goods and services that were available in the past. So, I mean, it's pretty incredible when people tell you their stories from different socialist and communist countries, how they've had their restrictions on freedom. It's not just the state censoring things like cookbooks, it's, banning people from protesting, arresting them if they do, arresting people if they speak out against the state, throwing them in jail. A girl from Cuba told us about what one of her friends has had to endure because he dared to speak out against the state. They threw him in a jail and they made him eat his food out of the same bucket where they he would have to use it for going to the bathroom. Like just absolutely disgusting behavior by the Cuban government there. But again, it boils down to just trying to control what people are able to say and do and think.
On your page, which is our viewers can find at secondstreet.org/socialism, you have a number of great videos there, interviews, and there's also one that is I think it's from PragerU, but it's about Che Guevara and the myth of this noble, heroic man, liberating people in first in Cuba and then in South America. And actually, it describes, was a very brutal man. He personally killed many, and had others, many were killed at his command. And just was a very selfish and self-serving person, really, not this noble hero. And yet you see at university campuses and high schools people wearing Che Guevara t-shirts and things like that. So the power, I think what your project, really the strength of it is, as you said, is in storytelling. And that doesn't mean making up stories, but allowing people who have lived through these things to tell their own stories. And that's this book, The Gulag Archipelago, which I just think was a really an important work for humanity. That's his book is just full of stories. It's about individual prisoners. It's not just about statistics, but the lives and the challenges that individuals went through, their anguish, their frustrations, their sufferings, and that really does it gets to your heart as well as to your mind, and that's what you're doing with your project, Survivors of Socialism.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the stories that I like as well, it's a bit of a different story that we did related to this because we weren't able to interview the person, but it involves Boris Yeltsin, the former president of the former Soviet Union. And there was an interesting story that I came across while I was working on this project, and it features Yeltsin, I believe it was a year or two before the Berlin Wall fell and the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so he wasn't president at this point, but he was a politician, high-ranking official in the Soviet government, and he ended up in the United States for a tour. And he went to a whole bunch of different places in the United States, and I had a whole bunch of really official meetings that he had to participate in. And the most influential activity during that entire trip, it wasn't even planned. He was in Texas, and if I recall the story correctly, he had just been to one of the space centers, and he had a bit of time in his schedule. So he said to I think the people that were handling the tour group, "Could I go and see a typical American grocery store?" And everyone was kind of surprised that Yeltsin wanted to do this, but they said, "Sure enough." And so they found this Randall's store is what it was called at the time. It was a grocery store. It was just a typical one in Texas, nothing special about it. And so Yeltsin popped in and was just absolutely amazed at the variety of food that the typical American could choose from, the vast quantities of food, too. I mean, everything. It was just a typical grocery store, but there was so much selection and so much volume of food. And there were no long lineups either, right? Not like the Soviet Union, where you might have only a couple different types of, say, cereals. And if they happen to even be in stock, right? So many things would be out of stock. There'd be long lineups to get in and so forth, because the state was running their grocery stores, whereas the private sector was running a typical US grocery store. So he was absolutely amazed by this trip. Kept kind of pinching himself to make sure it was true and couldn't believe it, but obviously understood that, yeah, it was a random trip. No one could have planned this, that this is how the typical American actually lived. And out of everything on that entire trip that he did, that one was the one that really shook him to his core to, I think, help Yeltsin come to the light and understand that market-based economies are far better for society than state-planned socialist and communist system. So that really influenced his decision to open up the Soviet Union when he became president, liberate things, try to have more of a market-based system, and so forth. So I found that to be a really fascinating story, because it's amazing how in history sometimes these inconsequential things, at least at the time, we think that they're really not that important, but they turned out to be immensely important for the people of the former Soviet Union, and for Yeltsin himself.
Well, we take so much for granted. A friend of ours who His father was still living in Russia. This is about maybe 20, 25 years ago. We were living in Alberta at the time, and that's where our friend lived. But his dad somehow was able to get to come from Russia to visit him, which is already amazing because many people could not get out of Russia. Mm-hmm. But he came to visit, and they were staying about maybe 200 miles or something like that from Jasper, or 100 miles or something. And my friend, who was an adult at the time and in a responsible position working in the oil industry, oil and gas, he said, well, let's go to Jasper today. I want to show you Jasper National Park. And his dad said, well, don't you have to get permission from the police to go there? And he said, oh, no, we just drive there. But his dad would not go with him until he called the RCMP and informed them that we're going to Jasper. And of course, the RCMP were kind of, well, yeah, thanks for letting us know. But, you know, it really has no bearing on. But his dad was so used to having every movement controlled that he wasn't comfortable in going without official permission from the police. So we're afraid that some things in our society are leaning in that direction. They talk about, you know, right now it's just talk, but about 15-minute cities. And once they get control, then they wouldn't want you to leave your own city for, you know, too often or whatever. Well, we're used to having the freedom to being able to travel wherever we want in Canada, and that's under threat. What are some of the other threats that you see and the people that you've interviewed have mentioned regarding, you know, what are some of the danger signs that they have seen in Canada that indicate that we could be sliding into a form of totalitarianism here?
Yeah, so one of the things that we did for this project I mentioned in the beginning was that we surveyed people from these nations. And one of the questions was, are there any policies in Canada that remind you of the regime that you're concerned about because they remind you of the regimes that you left? And we put that question in the survey, Rod, and I had no idea what people were going to say. I thought this could be really fascinating to see. And the number one issue that people raised was concerns over restrictions on freedom of speech.
Hmm.
They had listed two, I'm trying to remember the bill names, but they were two pieces of federal legislation that were aimed to restrict freedom of speech with online content and so forth. And the people we spoke with were concerned about that. And other things that they've seen in society too, where there's sort of this effort to really clamp down on what people can see, say, and how they treat it. It wasn't even just government. It was sort of how society, you'll see this, where you know, people get canceled and there's no opportunity for them to maybe clarify what they meant or apologize or whatever. It's just canceled, you're done. And so these... that was the number one concern that people had. Second to that, and I don't want to open up this can of worms, but there were a lot of concerns about how the pandemic was handled and restrictions on freedom there. I mean, you could understand that there were a lot of restrictions put in place while governments were fighting the pandemic, and how people that came from these countries, like you're describing, not being able to go to a government park, in your case, Jasper, without getting approval from the state first, right? I mean, so some of these restrictions that we saw in Canada were very concerning to people that came from socialist and communist countries. So it was an interesting project to work on and just see what people had to say.
Yeah. And with kind of socialism, the, you know, the good side of it, or the, you know, the desirable element that many people think is going to be the happy result of socialism, is, you know, sharing costs on things. So socialized medicine we already have in this country. Of course, right now our medical system pretty well from coast to coast is in a shambles, and it already was under strain before COVID, but certainly it's almost collapsed since then in terms of the weight wait times for surgery and so on. And I know on your site you have some specific information about that. Socialized education, we've had that for years. No longer are it seems that it's not that the parents have to think of how to educate their children, but they're just it's assumed that the kids are going to get on a bus and go to a central institution where someone else is going to determine the curriculum and the hours of study and sort of feed people through socialized drug use. And of course, there's been talk about universal basic income. These are all kind of related topics, but the idea that something that would take away incentive, and that's what you referred to that early in the game here. If people don't have incentive to work hard, to get up early, to do their best, to become the best, shoemaker or the best carpenter that they can be. If they're, with the universal basic income, it kind of would take away that incentive. So maybe comment on any of these as whatever's uppermost in your mind in terms of these government programs.
Well, and incentives are crucial, right? I mean, incentives affect everything we do day in and day out. And it's no surprise that when you don't have good incentives in place in socialist or communist countries, you end up with very poor results. And I can't recall the stats offhand because we issued this report a long time ago now, several months back, I think probably close to a year ago. But one of the examples that we included was looking at China and how, because their economy has gone through a great transformation over the past 40, 50 years. From very much a state-controlled, state-planned system to more of a free market type system. I mean, they still don't have the personal freedoms that we enjoy here in Canada, freedom of speech and so forth. But it is much more of a liberal economy than it was 40, 50 years ago. And one of the stats looked at the agricultural system. So you had these plots of land with the same people working on them. On say before the reforms and then after the reforms, and all they did was change the incentive structure so that people that were working these plots of land could suddenly start to keep some of the crops and that they had harvested. So now they had the incentive to work harder and do better so that these were better on the crops so that they get more of a crop yield for their different things that they're growing in that. And once they made these changes, well, lo and behold, you started to see more products coming from these same parcels of land. The only thing that changed was the incentive structure. And then suddenly everything became much more productive. So it's incredibly important. I mean, think of a couple examples of policies in Canada. A guaranteed annual income, I think, is one that. You know, in theory, maybe it sounds great. Okay, everyone's going to get all this money from the state, but you would see a reduction in incentives for people to work. And if you're on that bubble between maybe getting this income and not, well, then you're going to have less of an incentive to get up every day and work hard. I think if we're going to do anything in this country around incentives and that, we should be looking at things like lowering tax rates so that people know, well, hey, if I go out and get maybe a part-time job on the weekends, I can keep more of the money than, seeing maybe half go to the state or whatever it is, right? Depending on your income bracket. So if we want society to get ahead, I think we need to be looking at things like that, tearing down barriers that make it difficult to start up and operate a business. Looking at ways so that people can keep more of the earnings that they get from different jobs and that they're involved in, or maybe they keep more of the money from the business that they run, those types of things, rather than things like a guaranteed annual income.
Yeah, exactly. You may or may not know, Christian Heritage Party, we have a policy of supporting the fair tax, which would, rather than an income tax, it would be a tax on purchases, a general sales tax on purchases. but we would want to do away with the income tax, and then people, you know, there would be no disincentive. The harder you work, the longer hours you work, the more productive you are, the more money you get to keep and spend and save, whatever. And of course, for the government to, no matter how they tax, whether it's income tax or sales tax, for them to actually effectively reduce taxes, they have to stop wasting our money. So, which is that's the big deal right now. And I know you highlight some of that, both at the Taxpayers Federation, that's a big part of that work, and also at secondstreet.org.
Yes.
So
yeah, there's certainly a lot of room for improvement in government.
Yeah.
Give me 10 minutes with the budget and I'll save you a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly.
Just 10 minutes, that's all I want.
Colin, before we close, anything else that we haven't touched on that you want to highlight for our listeners?
I don't think so. I mean, I would just encourage people to go to the site, take a look at some of the videos. There's a policy brief there where we talk about our research into this area. Some of your listeners or viewers might have their own stories that they want to share, or maybe they know of someone who's got an interesting story. And if so, feel free to send me an email, colin@secondstreet.org, and be happy to hear what people have to say. And more than anything, I would just encourage people to share the link, especially with young people and those that think that socialism or communism are these magical systems that we just need to try it differently. And this is one of the great failures of these systems, is that everyone that comes along and espouses these ideas says, well, we would do it differently. And it's like, well, no, at the heart of these systems are people at the top that are managing and centrally planning everything. And it just does not work. It's an impossible system to get right. So it's much better when you have sort of the grassroots deciding how a society will live and what goods to produce and services to provide and so forth. And that grassroots approach is more of a market-based economy. And, you know, I wouldn't suggest for a second that, you know, an absolute 100% free market is what we need, because I think there is a role for government in our lives to levy some taxes on citizens and pay for services that are in the public interest, to organize things like, you know, building roads as an example, so people and goods can get from A to B. But again, we do much better off if we keep the size of the state small. So again, encourage people to take a look at the link and share it around.
Sure. We will have the link in our show notes, but for those that are listening on the podcast, it is Second Street, all spelled out, secondstreet.org. And then if you want to go directly to these interviews, it's secondstreet.org/socialism. And you see the great work that Colin and others are doing with their interviews. These are important. These folks that have survived and come out to tell their story, I think it's really important. And young people, especially, who may have gotten only part of the idea about socialism and government and left and right, need to listen to some of these stories and hear what people actually have to say who escaped. Colin
For
Craig,
sure.
secondstreet.org, thank you very much. Appreciate your time, appreciate your work, and keep up that good work. We're going to be visiting your site often to see what's new on your site. So thank you.
Well, thanks a lot, Rod, for the opportunity to talk with you and your audience.
All right. And we'll see the rest of you next week. Take care.